also really like Dick, the one about the two girls that like
end up... God damn you, you stole my answer. Welcome to another episode of Jabber and the Drone, the movie review podcast that politely disagrees to agree. Back again with me here in a new year, a new phase, Keith Foster from San Diego.
That was a weird intro. With me, as always, is Cassidy Robinson from Los Angeles, California.
Yes, and today we're going to be reviewing every movie.
Yeah, a lot of them.
It's been a couple weeks since we've done this. We've kind of had, we let the holidays happen. We tried to do it. And then, you know, our record and release schedule happened to land exactly on holidays. So we haven't been inactive. We've seen all the movies and we're going to kind of have a review-a-palooza here. Together, we're going to be reviewing Bumblebee and Vice. And then individually, we've seen Aquaman, Mary Poppins, and Green Book. But
yes,
we do have some stuff here at the beginning I'd like to get to as well. Do you want to do a consume obey? Do you have anything?
Yeah.
What have you been watching? What have you been reading? What are you obsessed with?
Have I talked about the Dark Tower series yet?
Like the Stephen King thing?
Yeah, Stephen King.
Have I mentioned that? I mean, you were reading that last year, weren't you?
Yeah, I'm almost done with it.
Audiobooking it, as it were?
Yeah. Yeah, I wasn't sure if I'd mentioned that before or not. But I have something else. If I have, you can edit that. I don't care. Whatever. I'm almost done with the Dark Tower series, so that's kind of fun.
All the towers.
But it has been, like, crazy... like movie times. I've, you know, holidays, I've been watching a lot of movies. Mm-hmm. I even did my semi-annual viewing of the Lord of the Rings trilogy.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so we just finished it the other night. It's just, for some reason, around the holiday season, I think that's because that's when those movies came out. Sure. But I always get a hankering to dive back into Middle Earth. And yeah, so that's what we did over the holiday season. And those movies hold up. The CGI.
I was just about to ask you that. I was going to say, do they age just a little worse every year?
The CGI a little bit, you know, mm-hmm. like Gollum is starting to look a little more cartoony, or I'm just starting to see the seams a little bit more than I used to.
Yeah.
Or, you know, like when Legolas does some of his ridiculous, before he's a flat out superhero in the Hobbit trilogy.
Right.
But like some of his stunts where he's like jumping on Oliphants and stuff. Yeah, though some of those age not great, but there are still movies that come out like this year that have worse graphics. So,
oh, sure. I would say the Hobbit movies had worse graphics.
Oh, one, yeah, 100%. So, I mean, they hold up pretty well. And, you know, like the scripting and the characters and everything else is still so tight that it's kind of crazy to think that those movies came out like almost... what, 20 years ago now? I guess 15 years ago.
Something gross like that, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, those came out when we were in high school.
Yeah.
But yeah, so Lord of the Rings trilogy.
Still into it, all these years later.
Yeah, it's just, it's like, it's to me like the perfect Thanksgiving thing.
Sure, it kind of has like the feeling, like watching those movies is kind of the feeling you get when you've ate too much Thanksgiving food and you're just like in a calorie coma.
Yeah, and by like, the end you're just like
high on tryptophan,
rolling over in your own filth.
Mm-hmm. The only thing I really have to talk about here in this segment is there's this band, this group that's been getting a lot of press over the year, and I've heard a little bit about them. They're a super group, kind of. That's three female singers, singer-songwriters who are all famous to some degree or another individually. Julian Baker, she's the most famous one. What's the other one's name? Lucy Dacus and Bridgers, something Bridgers. I can't think of her first name. But they came together and they recorded a 6-song EP in Idaho, actually. And yeah, like over the course of a week, just randomly put out this EP, and they've been touring on it a little bit. And I've heard the name, Boy Genius is the name of their group. And I've heard the name kind of thrown around a little bit. And then I've been listening to a lot of my music podcasts, and it's come up in a lot of their like end of the year lists. So I was like, okay, I'll listen to it. It's only 6 songs long. It's like less than 20 minutes, the whole EP on Spotify. And, you know, I've known who Julian Baker is for a while, and I've always thought that she's like good, but I never like totally understood the hype. I was like, okay, like she's good singer-songwriter, indie chick. Like, cool, I guess, like if you're into that. Very minimal, kind of like sorrowful song, slow type stuff. Just like her and a guitar accompanying kind of thing. And I always thought like she's a really good lyricist. She has a lot of emotion in her vocals, but I just wanted something a little bit more, like just maybe like more production or like a bigger band behind her or something like that. And this, I think, Boy Genius is exactly that. It like does everything I wish those other Julian Baker records did. And, you know, obviously all three of them are harmonizing. Sometimes they trade off vocals, who's doing lead, who's doing harmony. And it's just it's really good. It's just like really, really, really good. Kind of lo-fi. Like you can definitely hear the budget when you're listening to it. But for what they do in that, the songwriting is just like indestructible. And like you want to cry like 4 times during the record just because of like how overwhelmingly emotional the music is. It's really good. If you like kind of like singer-songwriter, indie folky type stuff, or just like really pretty music, it has a kind of a hint of like an alt country thing going on, but not like annoyingly so. Lots of reverb, like everyone's just, you know, everyone's vocals are bouncing off the walls. I love it.
All right.
It's really, really good. Check it out. Boy Genius, 6-song EP.
Cool.
And I'm probably the last person on the internet to recommend this. All right. Well, the other segment I wanted to get to is because today we're going to be talking about Vice, the biopic about ex-Vice President Dick Cheney, I put a survey to our listeners asking them what is their favorite film about a political figure, real or fictional. And we got a couple answers. I think I maybe left that a little too broad because some of these answers are a little goofy. But, you know, we can talk about these anyways. Nothing too long. And then we'll say our own. But Brandon Hall here says, Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, which is the exact kind of answer I was looking for. Did you ever see this one?
I don't think so.
It's a Jimmy Stewart, Frank Capra movie from, like, the 40s or 50s.
Yeah, I know of it, but I don't think I've ever seen it.
I think we watched it in government, high school government, because that's where I saw it.
I believe you were
in that class with me.
I don't know, man. Maybe I was sick.
You might have been, or you were just, like, not paying attention at all.
Maybe I have seen it. I don't know. I don't know, man.
The famous scene is when he does the filibuster. And I think that's why the movie was shown to us, is because we were talking about that, about a filibuster.
Oh, yes. I have 100% seen this.
Okay, yeah. So you remember he's all sweaty and he's been there for days or whatever?
Yeah, yeah. I don't really remember it. I do remember, like, that scene. I don't remember what he was filibustering about.
No, I mean, I remember the premise. Obviously, he's kind of a bumpkin who enters Congress and then, you know, has good intentions. Small town guy goes to Hollywood, or goes to Hollywood, goes to Washington. Mm-hmm. I remember it being fairly enjoyable. I mean, it held my attention for a 17-year-old. And so it must have been at least that good.
Yeah. I remember I enjoyed it, but I don't remember like enough
specifics. Yeah, I don't either. Yeah. I would have to watch it again. But I'll co-sign. I think that's a good pick. Yeah. Rachel Lee says that her favorite is Man of the Year, the Robin Williams movie.
She says, I wouldn't say favorite, but Man of the Year with Robin Williams was definitely interesting, especially given it was a comedy.
Right.
So she's not saying it's her favorite, but I think she just wants to bring it up for the conversation.
Sure.
Which I have not seen. So
I don't think I have either.
Have a conversation about it.
Yeah. I want to say this is one of those Robin Williams, Barry Levinson joints that came out around the time of like Bicentennial Man.
I think it was later than that, wasn't it? Wasn't it one of his last movies?
No, it wasn't that late. This was, I want to say it was like 2003-ish, something like that. I gotta look it up.
Yeah.
But yeah, you know, it's, people like that movie.
Oh, 2006.
Huh. Okay.
Yeah, I definitely haven't seen it, so I don't know.
Yep, no opinion. I love this next answer. Edgar says The Dead Zone, and of course any Cronenberg movie is always gonna get a thumbs up for me.
Is that a political movie?
Yeah, this is a David Cronenberg movie. Of course, it's based on the Stephen King novel, and about a psychic who played by Christopher Walken, and the main plot of the movie, besides a psychic played by Christopher Walken who has to, like, you know, he comes out of a coma and all of a sudden can't have relationships anymore. That's like the first half of the movie. The second half of the movie is all about how he's trying to stop this insane populist from becoming the president, because he can see into the future and sees that he's going to bring upon the nuclear apocalypse, and nobody believes him. It's played by Martin Sheen. That's a really, really good movie. Kind of a slow burn thriller.
So, I haven't seen it, actually, but is it overtly political, or is it, like, you know, is it the same logic that, like, Taxi Driver's a political movie?
It's more of a character study that happens to have a political plot. Or not gotcha. Even a political plot, but a plot that involves a politician. I mean, I don't think they ever, like, talk about, you know, policy or anything like that in any real way. It's just a thriller fodder that he happens to have to stop a politician.
All right. Well, in that case, Batman Returns might be my answer for this as well.
For Max Schreck? Or he's not even a politician.
But the
Penguin's going to be a...
Yeah, there's this whole subplot about how they're going to, like, get the mayor impeached.
And make him mayor.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and to do that, they use his own psycho circus army that people somehow don't know is connected to the Penguin.
Right, even though they both come from the sewer, yeah.
Yeah.
Diana Falcon, this is where the answers start to get a little confusing for me. Captain America Winter Soldier, cool movie, definitely, and definitely has a root in sort of political thrillers of the, like, 70s and 80s, but I don't know who the politician in question is here. Is it Red Skull? Not Red Skull. Who are the key players in that movie?
So there's Captain America, and then there's Robert Redford is like the
head of S.H.I.E.L.D. or something in that movie.
Yeah. I mean, I could see an argument for it. It's not, like, overtly political. I can tell this isn't, like, the type of answer you're looking for, because there's, like, movies about you know, more political stuff than...
Right. And I'm not even necessarily asking about movies about politics so much more as I'm talking about political figures. And if there was a fictional or real figure, like, say, something like the movie Dave, you know, or something like that, that's kind of more what I'm looking for. But I get what she's going for here. The movie has a, you know, some people said that it was kind of like a condemnation of like the surveillance states and that kind of stuff. Same here with Robert Barnett's answer, Inglourious Basterds. The political figure in question is Hitler, I guess? Or is it, there's a scene with Winston Churchill.
That raises an interesting question. You know, like, do war movies count as political movies? I don't know.
I would say neither of those movies are necessarily political movies. Although I could say the same thing about The Dead Zone, which I am going to give a pass to for the question, because there's a prominent political figure in the movie. But Inglourious Basterds and Captain America are more genre films that happen to use, like, I guess, political happenings as part of their plot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So what about you? Do you have a movie? I know you were maybe serious or joking about Batman Returns.
I mean, I do love that movie, but not. So there's a couple that are, because you mentioned like political figures. There's a couple that stand out to me. You actually mentioned one. I really love the movie Dave.
Dave's a good movie.
It's really fun. I do like a good political comedy. So I also really like Dick, the one about the two girls that, like,
God end up... damn you stole my answer.
That's such a good one. But honestly, the one I'm going to ask if it counts, because it's not really about any one political figure, but it is a very political movie, Dr. Strangelove, or How I Learned to Stop Worrying and Love the Atomic Bomb.
Sure.
Does that count? Because I freaking
Well, I would
love
ask
that
you
movie.
The same thing I'd ask them. Well, who's the political figure in question? Is it Dr. Strangelove? Is it the war general?
See, that's my question, because it is more about...
It's an ensemble film.
Yeah, it is more about... but, you know, there is... doesn't Peter Sellers play the president as well as
Dr. Strangelove?
He plays,
like, three characters in that movie. yeah, three or four. Yeah.
So if it's specifically about a political figure, I guess I'll go with Dick.
Yep, that's my answer too. And I thought it was going to be kind of like a deep cut. I thought you were going to go, oh yeah, I remember that movie.
No, I mean, kind of, but I don't know. Most movies about political figures, I think, are kind of stodgy and boring.
Yeah,
not
I mean,
boring.
Traditionally.
Not boring, but, not boring, but, I don't know.
Academic. Kind of dry.
Too self-serious, I guess.
Yeah. Or sort of historically oriented or something like that.
Yeah, like Lincoln. I enjoy
film.
Lincoln, but it's not like a fun movie.
No, I mean, there's some performances in there that stand out. But yeah, I know what you mean. For me, it's not something I'd revisit unless I was looking at it for, you know, to write a paper or something like that.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I mean, let's talk about Dick a little bit more, because I'm not sure if people really remember it. It was a comedy, came out in the late 90s, has Kirsten Dunst and Michelle Williams.
Michelle Williams.
And they live in the Watergate Hotel, and the movie presupposes, this is before the actual identity of Deep Throat was revealed, but the movie presupposes that these two ditzy teenagers in the early 70s were the ones who caught the break-in at the Watergate. And they're sort of talked into being the official dog walkers of Nixon to keep them quiet. And then they, you know, get in contact with the journalists at the Washington Post.
Woodward and Bernstein.
Yeah, Woodward and Bernstein. So it's kind of like All the President's Men meets like a teen comedy.
Yeah, it's like a...
it's a parody.
Yeah, I think it's directly references All the President's Men a few times.
Yeah, Will Ferrell and Michael Ian Black play Woodward and Bernstein very very well. I enjoy the hell out of that movie. Dan Hedaya is my favorite Nixon.
I mean, it's kind of a sleeper, just charming comedy.
Yeah, and it's one that I think, you know, it didn't like blow up at the time. I think it's well enough, but it is, I think, sort of something of a cult movie now.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of in the same vein as something like movies I'd say sort of came out around this time, like the Brady Bunch movie or Clueless, that have a similar sensibility. But this is more kind of farcical. There's a scene where Michelle Williams develops a crush on Richard Nixon, and she makes like scrapbooks with him and her together and stuff.
It's got a great, especially for 90s comedians, cast too.
There's a ton of SNL and Kids in the Hall members all over it.
Holy shit, Ryan Reynolds was in this?
Yeah, he has that one scene where he's working on the car and Kirsten Dunst makes out with him so that they can steal the Nixon audio tapes.
Wow, it's been a long time since I've seen this.
I have it on DVD. I bought it from Big Lots for $3.
I might need to revisit this.
Yeah, it's a good one. It's a good one. Okay, well, that's fun. Let's go ahead and start talking about all these damn movies we saw. And should we start with one we've seen together, or do you just want to get the quick hits out of the way?
Let's just get the quick hits out of the way.
All right, let's start with Aquaman, because I think that's the movie the most people have probably seen, and I'll let you do that. I did not see it. Sell me on Aquaman, if that is something you're inclined to do.
I still don't know. I still don't know if I liked this movie or if I hated it. It is about Arthur Curry is the titular Aquaman, played by Jason Momoa.
Yeah.
He is the child of an underwater queen and a human lighthouse keeper. The queen ends up having to go back to the ocean to fulfill her royal obligations. So he's raised on land.
I'm already bored.
Okay, yeah. So that's the thing with this movie. It's a DC superhero comic movie, right?
Yeah.
And it is...
directed by James Wan of The Conjuring fame.
That's sort of where this movie redeems itself. Because the script is god-awful. It is bad. It is like laughably bad.
Okay.
It is so pedestrian. Mm-hmm. It is so, like, the script is so paint-by-numbers, chosen one story,
mm-hmm.
but it is directed the hell out of.
Okay.
And it is definitely a challenge to all the critics of DC movies saying they're too dark and grim, because this is colorful popcorn candy. It is... It is insane. This is an insane movie. Like, I don't even know. There's times when it's a superhero thing. There's times when it's like an underwater King Arthur story.
Okay.
Black Manta is the coolest looking Power Rangers villain. it is so all over the place. And tonally, it's all over the place. And my big problem with it is it's like trying to go for sort of this Marvel-style humor, and a lot of that falls flat because Jason Momoa and Amber Heard have, like, negative chemistry together.
Yeah.
It's sort of reminiscent of Valerian.
Oh, okay.
So,
yeah.
So it's like there's a fun movie to be had, but there's so many problems bogging it down. My takeaway with it was they went for broke, and it goes there. It gets full on epic, super campy. I'm always going, what the fuck else are they gonna throw in this?
Yeah.
Of course they're gonna do this.
So everything in the kitchen sink.
Yeah, and despite me not really caring about any of the characters, which is a problem. and all, like all the comparisons you hear about it being, you know, sort of wet Thor and sure. stuff like that are valid. You know, like he has to defeat his evil half brother. But there is some amount of charm that I couldn't totally dismiss it. It's bonkers, but it is sort of a fun roller coaster ride. That being said, I don't think I'll ever need to watch it again.
So it at least has some sort of misguided ambition.
Yeah, and I can only sort of attribute it to the sort of popcorn camp direction of it. I sort of came out from it thinking of it as I called it Splash and the Furious. Because it has sort of that poppy sensibility to it.
Yeah. How's it paced? Are you bored at any moment?
Well, Ashley fell asleep like 5 times, but we did see a very late showing of it.
Yeah.
For the most part, I was with it. The beginning is really boring. It takes like 15 minutes to get to like the actual story.
Okay.
But once that sort of picks up, I was pretty much with it. It's fine.
All right. Do they have more chemistry with Amber Heard and Jason Momoa? Or less chemistry than Sally Hawkins and the fish guy from Shape of the Water?
Less, much less.
Oh, well, there you go.
It feels like they're doing... It sort of feels like how in cartoon movies, they talk about how they're very rarely in the same recording studio at the same time as like
right.
their castmates. It feels like that. It feels like they were acting at different... Like, that they weren't in the same scenes together.
They were composited in every scene.
Kind of, yeah. Which is a huge problem, because there's supposed to be, like, this love interest thing, you know.
What do you grade it, if you have to?
C+.
All right. Would you say it's better than Justice League?
Yeah, hands down. Of the DCU, I would still say it's probably their second best next to Wonder Woman.
Right, damning with faint praise, but yes.
Yeah, I mean... I would say it's a significant step up from the likes of Suicide Squad and Batman v Superman. It's at least fun to watch.
All right. I don't know if you sold me, but there it is. Well, let me talk about Green Book. I saw this one just a few days ago, not too long ago at all. And it was one of those ones that I hadn't initially planned on seeing, but it has been getting some traction lately. This is directed by Peter Farrelly of the Farrelly Brothers, and it's not, you know, kind of done in that usual gross-out comedy, broad comedic style that they're known for. And this stars Viggo Mortensen and Mahershala Ali, and it takes place in the 1960s. I think this is based on a true story where Ali's character... is a concert pianist named Don Shirley, and he's doing a tour through the American South in like 1962, and Viggo Mortensen is going to be his chauffeur. Mortensen's character is this kind of blue-collar, working man's Italian dude. He's been working nightclubs, you know, doing little odd jobs here or there, food eating contests, whatever he can do to get money for his family. His wife, played by Linda Cardellini. He's trying to, you know, just scrap up some money together. We see early on that Viggo Mortensen has some issues with race when two black plumbers are working and his wife gives them water and he decides he has to throw the cups away. So that kind of like informs you of sort of where he's coming from. But he gets this job working for Don Shirley to drive him around the South, and he's given what was called back then a green book, which was basically a guide for black people or people of color of which hotels and motels that they can stay in that are segregated from white hotels. So this movie has a lot to do with race. And, you know, he's driving him around, and it's a road movie. It's kind of a buddy movie. They learn from each other. And they kind of live like opposite lives, because Don Shirley comes from the world of academia and upper crust society, where he's playing, you know, classical piano for these, you know, rich white people. And he wants to sort of be as presentable as possible. He wants to be basically the best black man to ever exist, to sort of defy expectations of what that was. And Viggo Mortensen's this loudmouth, chain-smoking guy who eats in the car all day and swears all the time and doesn't give a fuck. And he's not particularly well-read or well-articulated or anything like that. So, and therein lies, I think, a little bit of my issues with the movie. It's a people-pleaser. It's supposed to be enjoyed. It was designed for, you know, punchline scenes and emotional scenes and, you know, heavy-handed messages about race and coming together and learning from each other. And that's all fine, and that's all... That works in all the ways that it's supposed to, and it's cheesy in all the ways that it's going to be. But it's also, I think, unintentionally a little condescending. And it reminds me... I mean, basically, this is Driving Miss Daisy in reverse. But it also reminds me a lot of those, like, Sidney Poitier... message movies from the 60s, like In the Heat of the Night and Look Who's Coming to Dinner. And the issue with those movies and why they don't age particularly well is because of this idea that Sidney Poitier had to sort of do exactly what Don Shirley feels he has to do in this movie, is to be the presentable black man. Be the... The perfect black man that isn't... doesn't have all of those stereotypes. You know what I mean? And the movie makes a point of pointing that out and tries to have a discussion around that. But I think it still sort of finds itself in a quagmire, a moralistic quagmire about how they decide to discuss this issue throughout the movie. I mean, for instance, there is an extended fried chicken joke that goes throughout most of the movie, which... I thought was a little tone deaf, and I mean, again, the movie thinks it's talking about these issues, but I think kind of doesn't understand that it's still sort of bumbling around them.
Gotcha. So I have a question.
Okay.
I don't know how to approach this. Does it make you uncomfortable as a white person, I'm not even gonna get into it.
No, I'm genuinely interested where you're going with this, like, question.
Are you sort of uncomfortable by it as a white person trying to be empathetic to black people, or does it genuinely? You know what I mean? I don't know. Like, does it make you uncomfortable because you feel like you should be, or is it the movie's failing? Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, I think I know what you're getting at. My issue with this is produced by Octavia Spencer, and who won an Oscar for her role in the movie The Help.
Mm-hmm.
And this reminds me a lot of sort of the easy neoliberal politics of that movie.
Gotcha. Okay. So it sort of...
It has this kind of like pat yourself on the back, like, okay, white people, we're going to watch this movie together and learn how to bridge the racial gap together.
And it sort of oversimplifies it.
Very oversimplified. And also, I think it kind of comes off as condescending to people who are more sort of in that Viggo Mortensen lane, where it's like, oh, let's, like, there's a scene in the movie where they're driving around, and obviously he's never been anywhere but New York, and he's like, oh, look, you know, look at the culture and blah blah blah, and he's like, you know, he's learning things as he goes, and his world is expanding. That's true, that being more traveled and well read is going to make you have a broader understanding of the world, but it also kind of feels like the movie is like holding the hands of what of the straw man character they have essentially invented to teach an entire culture about racism. You know what I mean?
Gotcha. Yeah.
In like a very one-on-one sort of way. Okay. And that's my issue with the movie. And that was sort of my issue with The Help. And I think that most people who go see this movie are not going to see this at all. They're going to have a great time. They're going to laugh at all the things they're supposed to laugh at. And they're going to, you know, be taken with the relationship stuff. And I think Viggo Mortensen and I'm destroying this name every time. Mahershala Ali are very, very good and very convincing. I love Linda Cardellini and everything. She's only in a few scenes, but very effectively so. It's directed nice. It's paced well. Just the entire messaging of the movie, I feel, is dated and awkward.
Okay. All right.
Let me give that a grade. I'm going to give it...
Oh, yeah.
I'm going to give it a C+.
Okay.
Yeah.
It's right on track with Aquaman. All right, so the last
Mary Poppins.
Sort of quickie review I'm going to do is Mary Poppins Returns. This is a sequel. This is a sequel to the original Disney Mary Poppins from the 60s. It is a direct sequel. It's decades after the Banks children have grown up from the first movie. They have lives of their own now. Their parents are gone, presumably passed away. The son, Michael Banks, has now inherited the family house. However, his wife passed away a year ago, and he's fallen behind on all the bunch of bills. He owes a loan to the bank. But he has some magical bank shares hidden away somewhere, but he can't find them. So he thinks he's going to lose the house. The pressure of everyday adult life is straining him, and his kids are far more adult than they should be for their age. And so Mary Poppins comes sailing in on her umbrella to add a little joy and music and whimsy to their world. This is directed by Rob Marshall, who I think is the only musical director in the game right now. So my overall impression of this, and I know you're shamefully not a fan of the original Mary Poppins, which in all fairness, I haven't seen in a really long time. But this is, you know, very much a spiritual successor as well as a direct sequel. It's filled with musical numbers and nonsense, and you don't know how much of it is sort of the children's imagination of Mary Poppins and what's sort of actually happening. There's long, very colorful musical numbers with very, you know, extended set pieces. The story of it is, you know, is pretty simple. It's child grows up to become an old grump and learns, you know, relearns that there's more to the world than owning a home and having money.
Yeah.
And, you know, there is something to be said about family and togetherness. You're going to get exactly what you think you're going to get out of a Mary Poppins movie. It's bright. It's colorful.
Dance around with 2D animation?
They do. And it is gorgeous. That was probably my favorite sequence of the whole movie. There's a sequence where they like go into this bowl and it's a cartoon bowl. Man, I forgot how much I love seeing 2D animation on screen. Mm-hmm. And the costumes are great. That sequence in particular stood out to me because I was just like, animation like this doesn't exist in movies anymore. Like, it doesn't exist.
Yeah.
I wondered, is the Princess and the Frog, is that the last animated feature to, like, traditional 2D animation feature to be released on big screen?
No. I mean, there's, you know, I mean, there's, like, foreign films that are always coming out that are in 2D. But as far as, like, from Disney or from, like, a major American studio?
Yeah, I just, I feel like after seeing that sequence in particular, I just, it made me very sad because I feel like something has sort of been lost with animation. Mm. And we're doing new incredible things with animation. Obviously, Pixar is always pushing the barrier. We just got, you know, Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse is going to be, I think, a sort of a watershed moment for animated,
which plays features. Around with a combination of 3D and 2D.
It does, but it's not the same. I don't know. There was just, it hit me very nostalgically during the animation sequence in particular.
Mm-hmm.
I did think that, like, the music isn't quite as catchy as the original, but, but actually... Yeah,
is there any Chim Chiminis or Expialidocious? Like, is there anything that people are going to be singing 50 years later?
There's no, like, instant earworm kind of things like that. I didn't think the music was quite as iconic. It's good. I mean, it is...
Mm-hmm.
And you can kind of feel... Lin-Manuel Miranda's influence on it, and he is just such a an entertaining person, and he sort of takes what's his name's place, the chimney sweep's place. He's like a lamplighter in London.
Dick Van Dyke.
Yeah. I think he's a suitable spiritual successor. I think as far as sequels go to movies from the 60s, yeah, it was a lot of fun. It's charming. It's family friendly. There's songs and dances. You're going to get out of this movie exactly what you think you are. There weren't really any surprises. It's definitely a Mary Poppins joint. Okay. So if you're a fan, I'd recommend it. If you didn't like it, the original as much, I don't know that it's going to be for you. I think there are better sort of children movies, although Ben Whishaw does play the eldest Banks, the grown-up Banks boy, and it did make me, like, weirdly want a Mary Poppins Paddington crossover. And I'll just leave my review on this one note, because I think it's insane. Julie Andrews has a cameo... Uh-huh. In Aquaman.
Oh,
but
man.
Not in this. She that chose to do an Aquaman cameo. And there's definitely a part that they clearly wrote for Julie Andrews.
In the new Mary Poppins?
Yeah. The cameo that they do get is still pretty great.
Yeah.
And I won't spoil that for people who haven't seen it yet. But I am flabbergasted.
That is weird.
Mary Poppins and Aquaman have a weird connection, and it's Julie Andrews.
And the singing to the fish part.
kind of. But yeah, I thought it was charming and delightful, but it is sort of, it will sort of leave you once you leave the theater, I think. I don't think it's going to be like an instant classic or anything, but it's...
Right.
It's, it's a serviceable Disney family flick. I was never, annoyed by it. I would give it a B+.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that's pretty high praise.
Yeah, I mean, it was entertaining in all the right ways.
All right. Well, let's go ahead and get started on Bumblebee. I think we should talk about this. I will set it up, I suppose. This is directed by Travis Knight. This is the first film in the Transformers franchise, or Transformers Extended Universe, are we going to call it now?
No, no we're not.
No. That is not directed by Michael Bay. And boy, can you tell.
right?
This stars Haley Steinfeld as a young girl. This takes place in 1987, which is actually not something I knew about it before seeing it. But she starts this young girl named Charlie. She's kind of a tomboy who works on cars. Her father died, and she doesn't get along with her mom and their new stepdad. And she comes across a yellow bug, that a broken-down, old-looking yellow bug that her uncle has tarped in his junkyard, and she decides, you know, she's going to try and fix it, and if she can fix it, it's going to be hers for free. They live somewhere in Northern California in sort of the small towns. She works at a corn dog place on a boardwalk summer job thing that she hates. After she revives the car, she also revives Bumblebee, who is escaped a war on Cybertron and is a sort of political refugee living on Earth and is being hunted down by the evil Decepticons. And as soon as he is revived, he sends a signal out to the people who are on the hunt for him. So as she's having fun with her new pet robot, who has no memory of where he came from or what he is, there is also a hot pursuit by two Decepticons. And you are more of the Transformers guru than I am. So you're going to have to tell me, who were those Decepticons, Keith? Are they canonical?
I don't know. I think they might have been a mashup. Honestly, the way the Transformers movies have sort of translated Transformers into big screen is similar to like the X-Men universe. So right. It's like they'll take names and characters but give them like totally different attributes and stuff. Right. So I don't know if these guys were...
They might be composites of other characters.
Yeah, but, you know,
it doesn't matter.
No,
I just was going to give you the floor on that because I thought you might have, having been a fan of the 80s cartoon and whatever, you might have known more about those characters than I did. But all that matters is they're bad.
Yeah, those two didn't stand out to me. But for people who are fans of the cartoon and, you know, the 80s iconography and stuff, I mean, the first five, I posted this on Facebook, the first 5 minutes of this movie pull off what Michael Bay has not been able to achieve in five movies.
That's right. Yeah. I watched the first three and stopped after that because at a point it's just like, why do I keep doing this to myself?
I stopped after four.
Saw The Last Knight or whatever it was called?
No, I just couldn't. I couldn't do it. And I couldn't convince Ashley to go. And I'm like, I don't want to. And I don't want to sit through another 5 hour movie of nonsense. I tried to like those movies. And just at a certain point, they broke me even. And I was like, I can't do it anymore. But yeah, like, you get to see the Transformers look like Transformers. Like, they look like the characters from the cartoons, but, you know, like, adapted for a movie. And, the action doesn't look like you just dropped two tool belts in a blender and pressed on. Like, they look like characters doing things.
It's comprehensible. The camera's pulled back enough during the action sequences that you can kind of get an idea of who is where and what is what. And yeah, there's not a whip pan or something, some crazy editing in every single shot.
Also, kudos to this movie for having, you know, a young female protagonist without, you know, extended shots of her ass for most of the movie. It doesn't sexualize her at all, even, which is kudos to them for not being creeps about it.
I feel like the underlying mission statement of this movie was to kind of be the antithesis of those other movies. Like, it really took to heart all of the criticism that they've received for years. It kind of feels like it's trying to sort of apologize for the Michael Bay series and sort of doing the opposite of what they've always done. Instead of a male lead, we have a female lead, and she's not sexualized. And I think she's a genuinely interesting character.
Yeah.
She has her own, like, stuff going on in the movie. And the reason why I went and saw this after giving up on Transformers ages ago is that I saw the trailer. Everyone saw the trailer, and it looked like there's a moment in the film that has more emotion than I've seen in five movies. And I thought that it kind of looked like it was had a little bit of sort of an E.T. vibe in places, or a Iron Giant kind of vibe.
I think that that is a very fair comparison. I loved that this movie was set in the 80s, first of all.
It does away with a lot of that kind of high-tech jargony stuff that that always were a problem in the other movies.
Well, I just mean in general, like, sort of the fetishization of the 80s nostalgia is so huge that I've always said, like, if they're going to do a reboot of these movies, and I specifically thought of it for, like, the Ninja Turtles, because their dialogue is sort of so dated.
Yeah.
I was like, if I ever had a chance to direct one of these big 80s franchise movies, I would set it in the 80s as like a period piece.
Right.
And so I loved that they did that and sort of exploited, I'm not even gonna say exploited, but utilized sort of, you know, like the era these characters came from in a fun way. And it does have that sort of 80s E.T., you know, alien adventure.
Yeah, story. That kind of Amblin era vibe.
Yeah.
And I would say that one of the things about this movie that struck me, and this might be a positive or a negative depending on who you are and how you feel about those other Transformer movies, I think this movie skews younger than the other movies.
And interesting.
I think that this movie feels a little kiddier and a little bit more kid-friendly.
Compared to the other innocent. Ones. Yeah, I would say for sure compared
to... It's not as hyper-violent. I mean, there are, you know, there's action scenes and stuff blows up, but it doesn't feel like it's just an assault on your senses for the duration thing. The parents aren't getting high on college and then talking about their son's dick and, you know, all this humping robots and all of that kind of, like, dumb locker room humor that peppered the Michael Bay movies. This movie kind of does away with all that, and it feels like it's much more kind of, yeah, it kind of feels like something like a Explorers or a Flight of the Navigator.
Yeah, I would have loved this movie when I was that age, when we would watch movies like Time Bandits and shit like that.
Sure.
I think that there's also something to be said about the fact that I don't think that there's a lot of movies targeted to that middle range anymore. It seems like
7 to 12-year-old age.
Yeah, it seems like movies are either sort of over kidified now, or or over adultified. I guess so. Yeah. It either plays down to the intelligence of children, or it just assumes that if there's any kids in the audience, they won't catch the adult stuff. I loved that this. I agree with you completely. It's felt more, felt a little more safe than some of the other Transformers movies. And
well, I don't like the word safe because I think that implies that the movie isn't taking chances, and actually. The whole experiment of doing this movie in that tone is taking a chance.
This is
kind of a soft reboot.
No, I don't mean safe. I mean like content wise. Like
no, I would have
no problem with anyone. You know, like if I had a kid watching this.
This movie isn't condescending to the audience like the others were. This movie actually likes the audience, and it isn't just like trying to. It doesn't feel like it's trying to just suck the money out of your wallet and merchandise as much as possible.
Yeah, it feels like...
It's a big Hollywood production, so certainly it's interested in doing that too. But I think that the director actually wanted to also make a good movie.
It also felt like he was a fan of the franchise.
Understands the original appeal.
And he wanted to deliver those moments that we never got from the other movies. Like in the, you know, in the first fucking minute, Soundwave shows up and is like launching shit out of his body. And it's like, how did it take so long to get a sequence like this that actually feels like the Transformers I grew up with?
Right.
And so it gives you, as a fan of the Transformers, it gave me exactly what I wanted. And then it it goes on to, you know, to create its own story that felt much more spiritually in line with the Transformers franchise than anything Michael Bay did. Like, there's actually a reason for him to be a robot in disguise.
Yeah, exactly.
Which is something that the you know, the other movies, they just sort of turn into cars. And in this, it's like, oh, there's actually like a purpose, like a story driven purpose behind that. Cool.
Yeah, for sure.
And I even enjoyed John Cena, despite the fact that I don't want to see him in movies anymore.
Well, he's just started, so.
Oh, no.
Yeah, you know, yeah, he's fine in the movie. He's not my favorite thing in it, but he serves his purpose. I will say, because I think the movie is genuinely trying to skew a little younger, mm-hmm. I was a little taken back by the simplicity of the dialogue when it first started. And I thought that it was like, oh, why is everyone kind of talking in these like short, succinct sentences? Like, it feels a little written. And then once I realized the tone of the movie and what it was going for, and also Hailee Steinfeld delivering it much better than everybody else, I was able to kind of roll with it. But it is the dialogue, I would say, could have been massaged a little. Yeah, you know, I think that's really my only complaint. I think the goofy parent stuff tips a toe maybe over the line. Like, it never gets to the place as bad as the Michael Bay movies, but I think there is a little bit like, that is something they did in those movies, so maybe let's do it here.
Yeah, I kind of was, I agree. They never like ruined the movie or were as obtrusive as the parents, but there was a moment that I was like,
they're in the movie a hair too much.
Yeah, I'm okay with not seeing them anymore.
I'm not saying that we had to kill the characters off or anything.
No.
Even be in the next one or whatever. But yeah, there was a scene in the movie where I was like, okay, I'm done with you. You don't need to be in the movie anymore.
That's what I mean. Honestly, my only real problem with this movie is that it is still connected to the Michael Bay movies. Like, it is a direct prequel. Like, in that sort of frustrates me about this. I think this would have been a really good opportunity for just like a clean slate reboot. And I would have, if they were interested in continuing the Transformers franchise, I would be much more interested in sort of seeing the further adventures in like the 80s and stuff like that, you know. Mm-hmm. I don't need it to connect to the Michael Bay movies. Like, I'm sure, you know, legally they had to do it that way, but that was my only real problem with it. Is I was like, we don't need it to connect it to the Michael Bay. Like, let's just. I would have loved it to be just like a full reboot.
Yeah, I mean, I think the especially when it's really close timeline wise of when the last movie was released, it has been the tradition to do something more like a soft reboot, like we saw with how the X-Men franchise did that with First Class. And I think that's kind of what this movie is going for. I think it's setting out a new epoch, if you will, for this franchise. It's like those other movies exist, and maybe we're taking this thing or that thing from it, but for the most part, I think people are supposed to see this as a reboot.
We'll see
how, like, the others
fall. There are a few direct connections to
as there were direct connections from First Class to the Bryan Singer movies, but there were also places where it decided, but let's not worry about that.
That's true. I hope so. I hope so, because I am definitely a lot more interested in, you know, the continuing adventures of these Transformers than the shit before, because, you know, it was actually an enjoyable movie with a story and characters.
Yeah, no, I agree. I give it a B+.
Yeah, that's what I'd give it to.
And more people should go see it. It kind of got lost in the shuffle of the holiday season, and I think more people ended up seeing Aquaman ultimately. It'll probably make its money back overseas, because these movies always do well over there. But mm-hmm. yeah, if you haven't seen it yet or you were on the bubble on it because you didn't really like the others, I'd say definitely go see it.
I actually had a lot of people say that to me, like, oh, this one isn't directed by Michael Bay. I'm suddenly interested.
If they're kind of more of a snooty film persuasion, tell them that this is directed by the same guy who did Kubo and the Two Strings and has been in the animation department over at Leica Films.
Yeah, for sure. And like you said, I think it's important to reiterate that this is sort of the anti-Michael Bay. It is definitely trying to be a bit of an antidote to the nasty taste his movies have left in our mouth.
For sure. For sure. All right, Keith, go ahead and describe the plot of Adam McKay's biopic, Vice.
Okay, so this is... Vice is... It's about former Vice President Dick Cheney. It's sort of a biopic story showing sort of how he worked his way up into the White House and eventually found himself as the most powerful vice president ever in history. And, you know, possibly one of the most powerful people, you know, to ever live, and what he sort of did with that power and for better or worse, mostly worse.
I don't know how you can really argue for better, but
I know. And this is, you know, it's directed by Adam McKay. It is meant to not even just be a warts and all piece. It is meant to just be sort of a warts piece. It is meant to really highlight some of Dick Cheney's greatest hits, if you will. Yeah, I don't know. Is that enough of a setup?
Yeah, I suppose so.
It is it is directed by Adam McKay, very similarly to The Big Short. So there's a lot of, you know, sort of jumping around in time, a lot of sort of absurdist transitions.
Breaking the fourth wall, asides, things like that. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so it isn't just like a straightforward, you know, he was born, he grew up, he became vice president type of thing. It is sort of all over the map. It is more interested in portraying a certain tone and than necessarily a strict
retelling of historical events.
Yeah.
And I would call this a satire. I think that is the goal of the movie more so than just you know, doing an A&E biopic or a TV of the movie of the week kind of look at his life. I think there is a lot of snark here, you know, with intention. Adam McKay comes from the world of political comedy. He was a writer on SNL for years, and it was instrumental in sort of shaping how they covered politics in the late 90s. And then he went off and did a lot of those Will Ferrell joints that we've come to love, like Anchorman and Step Brothers and that kind of stuff. Which is funny because there's a new Will Ferrell movie out that he didn't do, but
yeah, and I wanted to see it. I've heard nothing good about it, so
and then neither have I. It didn't look particularly good either. That the Holmes and Watson thing, but yeah, I think that this and The Big Short kind of show an evolution in his kind of the marriage between Adam McKay, the political activist, because he's always been very politically vocal, particularly on the left, and Adam McKay, the satirist. And I've liked both movies, a decent amount. But you know, before we get into too much stuff as far as, you know, comparing or whatever, what were your general impressions? We also didn't mention, Christian Bale stars here as Dick Cheney. Amy Adams plays his wife. Steve Carell plays Donald Rumsfeld.
An all-star.
Sam Rockwell plays, W.
Yeah. All-star cast. Really good ensemble. What were my initial thoughts? I have some issues with Adam McKay as a director. I mean, his movies are so directed that it's impossible to not sort of feel him pulling you in a certain direction.
He keeps it. He leaves his fingerprints all over it.
Yeah, and he never, there aren't really any scenes that he just sort of leaves for interpretation. He's telling you exactly what he thinks of these characters. You know, that being said, for political thrillers, you know, again, sometimes they can be boring. Sometimes it's hard to sort of know, keep track of what's going on, because I'm not really into politics, shocker. You know, I think most people have a pretty pedestrian understanding of politics and how things get done. Mm-hmm. And, you know, this is very entertaining. It's very funny.
Yeah.
It's very easy to watch. It's very clever. And it knows exactly how clever it is.
Yeah, that's true.
You know, sometimes I think to the movie's detriment.
Yeah.
But overall, you know, it did exactly what the movie is designed to do. It entertained me and infuriated me.
Right.
You know, it sort of almost feels like a documentary, because it's got this voiceover narration. From Jesse Plemons.
Mm-hmm.
That makes it feel like a really high class reenactment.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know. It is, like I said, it's hard for me because generally I agree with Adam McKay's politics, but I feel him manipulating me. And mm-hmm. as an audience goer, like, my instinct is to reject that. You know, my like a magician doing his act, and he wants you to look at one hand, and so instead of, like, doing the trick, he goes, hey, just look at this hand. Just look at this hand, and you'll get the trick.
Yeah.
You know, so it is a bit, I don't know.
But I don't think that the trick necessarily is agree with my politics, although I think he's interested in that. Like I said, the movie has an activist bent, as did The Big Short. But I think the trick is actually find this information entertaining, because I think he has two challenges, which is one, he's telling very recent political history that everybody knows,
everybody knows some version of events,
because we were there to live it. I mean, for the most part, unless you're very, very young, but you know, if you were there, it was on your TV every day. We experienced these things in real time, so everyone kind of has their version of the story already in their head. Adam McKay's challenge is to show you sort of the behind the scenes of what we thought we knew, or what has come to light since then, which some people have paid attention to, some people haven't. And then I think the other big challenge is to sell Dick Cheney as a person, as an interesting character, because he himself, and the movie, I think, does a good job at portraying this, particularly through Christian Bale, through his performance. He is a very kind of sullen, stoic personality. He doesn't speak very much. He speaks in very, you know, monosyllabic, one-word sort of answers. He means what he says, and he's sort of a Machiavellian, where he is more, he doesn't want to be noticed. He worked his whole career not to be noticed.
Mm-hmm.
But he, you know, wielded this incredible influence and this incredible power by hiding in the shadows. And I think the way that McKay makes up for both of those things is he has every other character in the movie be these very loud, very brash, scene-stealing kind of performances. And then the movie itself has this kind of quick-cut, MTV-style sort of rock and roll energy that he's selling it with. And I think I think you're correct in saying that, like, sometimes that objective reveals itself too much, to the point of the movie is sort of showing off.
Yeah.
And I think sometimes that there were times and scenes when I think of maybe a slightly more skilled director, or a director who has a little bit more confidence in storytelling, would have let a scene marinate a little bit longer, or to really kind of get into the nuance of a performance, rather than, you know, have Steve Carell kind of shrieking as Donald Rumsfeld and just telling you what the scene is about in dialogue.
Yes, exactly. And those were I sort of wanted that a little bit more. Like, I feel like there were some great performances, but
yeah.
I felt like they were sort of hollow because I never got a sense that these were not actors playing these people.
Right. Yeah. I mean, with the exception of Christian Bale, who is giving the most subtle performance here because the movie calls for it, even though he put on a bunch of weight and is a bunch of makeup and he'll be noticed for that. But the actual performance itself is extremely subtle. Everybody else, you wouldn't miss a beat. You wouldn't blink if in the middle of the scene, they took off their wig and started addressing each other by the actor's name.
No, not at all. Like
that would be very on brand for this movie.
Yes, exactly. And that's what I mean. And I even felt that a little bit with Christian Bale. Like I wanted some, like you said, some of those scenes to marinate a little bit more. I wanted the movie to show a little bit more, but instead it's so interested in telling me their version of events,
yeah.
in a very quippy, entertaining way. But I did want it to sort of slow down and just be a movie for a minute.
Yeah, I think that Adam McKay struggles a little bit as a writer
because
dealing with exposition. And I think that the way he deals with exposition is in these like fun, entertaining asides. Like there's a scene where Dick and his wife are in bed, and I think Jesse Plemons says, you know, normally this would be the scene in like a Shakespearean play where they would, you know, outright talk about how they're going to take over the world or whatever, but that doesn't happen in real life. And then the movie cuts directly to them in bed talking about how they're going to take over the world in Shakespearean verse, yeah. Which is hilarious. It's a really fun scene.
And the, you know, the scene, there's a scene where they're literally ordering you know, all of these war crimes off of a menu in a restaurant. It's right. Very entertaining. Yeah. But I think there were opportunities for actual movie scenes. Like there's a part at the beginning where Amy Adams is chastising Christian Bale Dick Cheney because he's a bit of an alcoholic. She just brought him out of jail. And the scene sort of resolves all of the dramatic tension so quickly and efficiently because the movie's not really interested in that. And that moment is sort of the closest thing there is to a character arc for... And I think part of the problem here, I think part of the problem with this movie is that Adam McKay is so interested in making us hate Dick Cheney, which isn't hard to do.
No.
And he doesn't want to humanize him at all. And I get that.
I would question that a little bit, but go ahead and say what you're going to say.
The last shot of the movie is pretty damning.
No, yeah, I know.
But I think part of the problem is the movie has no, I never felt like it had an interest in sort of portraying a character. I feel like it's all interested in just like, look at the evil shit this guy does. You know, it's not a character piece in that, like, we're not meant to really understand his motivation or anything like that. It's just meant to show what an evil son of a bitch he is.
Okay. Here, I'll push back on that a little bit. I think that Dick Cheney, whatever kind of humanizing we get from the character, I think we get from Christian Bale's performance mostly. I put a lot of weight on the success of this movie on that performance.
As aggressively
directed as it is, I think that the reason why I don't feel that the movie completely does that is mostly because Christian Bale committed to internalizing this character in a way that doesn't feel like he as an actor is judging him.
I agree with what you're... I do agree with that, but I think that the movie... The movie,
the point
sort
of the movie
goes...
is not to make him look good, for sure.
No. The movie cuts away from that so much that I feel like a lot of that internalized performance sort of gets lost.
Gets lost in the editing. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
I mean, the movie in general is very fractured and postmodern and whatever. But I think that the overall point is that Dick Cheney is not... He's not necessarily condemning Dick Cheney alone. He's condemning the political process that created Dick Cheney. He's
sure.
condemning...
Yeah.
He's talking about power, political power, as being mostly a transactional thing. Mm-hmm. And mostly a kind of cynical thing.
No, I understand all of that. I just mean, like... And I don't need the movie to, like, give me a tragic backstory of Dick Cheney or whatever. In fact, I don't think that would serve.
I will say there was a lot more in this movie about Mary Cheney than I thought there would be.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's true.
Played by Alison Pill. Mary Cheney is a lesbian. And that was always kind of a thing that people, like, talked about but not really talked about. And I thought that it would come up maybe, but I did not know it would end up being coming kind of a big plot point.
Yeah. I guess what my point is I just wanted there to be a few moments for this movie to sort of relax its cleverness and have some scenes where the actors get to act is like, I felt like all of the actors were doing good performances. They were just so, yeah.
Tied to the style of the filmmaking.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. No, I agree with that. I feel like I like the movie ultimately. And I think that if this is how people learn about this person and of this period of time, specifically the first 4 years, the first term of Bush Jr., I think that, which a lot of political pundits and political historians have called the Cheney years, because after the re-election, he starts to cede power a little bit as Bush sort of catches wind to that agenda. Or some have theorized, that's never been stated by anybody who's in the movie. But yeah, I think if this is the way they learn about that, in the same way that the Big Short is the way that people learn about the housing bubble and all of that, that's fine. And I think that, you know, at the very least, it could pique interest into maybe looking into it more or whatever. And I think the movie accomplishes what it's trying to do as being both an entertaining film and as a political piece. But I agree with you. As a piece of storytelling, it's a little too aggressive and a little too single-minded.
Yes.
And
yeah. Those are great. I think great words to describe it. There's not really any room left in the movie for sort of anything but Adam McKay's agenda, and that
right.
sort of is what's frustrating, because I felt like with this cast and with the performances we saw, I do feel like maybe there could have been a little bit more nuance at times. That being said, you know, I also really liked it. I mean, it's a very fast pace. It's very
it's a
poppy.
Breezy 2 hours and 12 minutes.
Yeah, and it, you know, it's gonna really upset you. I don't know.
Yeah.
It very much
doesn't
upset
matter
me.
What side of the aisle you're on. You'll be upset by something.
Well, yeah, that's true. Cool. Is that all we got on this?
Yeah, that's all I have to say about it. I give it... I think I'm just going to give it a B. Just B average. I might have given it a B+ in my written review. I don't remember now. But yeah, that's where I'm at right now.
B+ sounds good to me.
Okay.
I'd say that's about right. Yeah, I think it falls just a little short of being, like, mind-blowing. Especially because I think... We sort of saw a lot of these tricks with The Big Short before.
Sure.
You know, maybe, I don't know. I felt like there weren't as many surprises because of that movie. Like, I was sort of expecting that, And, you know, it does deliver on that end. So I guess it's not really fair for me to expect Adam McKay to, like, totally reinvent him and his style.
Right, yeah. But, I would wish that if he's to continue to lean in this direction, that he becomes less concerned with having a signature style. I think that I think he can still be funny and satirical and that kind of stuff, but I wish he would do it more in scene and less like with the distancing techniques and the asides.
Yeah, which I enjoy those, but I think you could be a little more parse with them.
Yeah.
And they, you know, they might pack a little more stronger punch if it wasn't sort of the whole movie.
Right. Okay, well, that is the podcast. We're actually going to hold off on our Netflix homework for The Last Dragon. We had so much to review this week. So we're going to, and next week we're going to be doing our top tens. So we'll be holding off on The Last Dragon until we have our next traditional style episode. But if anybody has anything to say about anything we talked about in this podcast, you can email us a response over at jabberandthedrone@gmail.com. You can contact us or find us, follow us on Twitter at jabberpodcast or on Instagram at jabberpodcast, as well as on Facebook at facebook.com/jabberpodcast. You can also follow me individually on Twitter at VC Cassidy, although I'm starting to kind of convert to Keith's delete Twitter mentality.
Oh man, I haven't been on Twitter in like a month and a half, and my life is better for it.
I'm almost happy. There. I'm almost just, there.
Just delete the app. Just delete the app. I still have my Twitter account. It still exists, yeah. But I just am never going to use it again.
Yeah. The unfortunate thing is if you're a writer and you like get a job in media, sometimes they want you to have one. But
you know,
anyway.
I sort of have always kept my social media profiles for the same reason, you know, being a comedian. But you know what? I figure that's why I'm not going to delete my account. That way it's there if I need it. Mm-hmm. But until I need it, fuck it. There is no accountability on that app. And the people who run it, I honestly think have contributed to the world being a worse place.
You're not wrong. Okay, so do that. Follow us on Twitter. What else? You can read my movie reviews that I post weekly, or they post weekly, at the IdahoStateJournal.com. Click on the news tab. Click on the entertainment tab. Movies should be somewhere in there. Read the stuff. My Vice review should be posting here pretty soon. And what else? I think that's all I have. Keith, what's your stuff?
Follow me on Instagram at Keith Foster Kid. You can find me on Facebook. Check out my website, www.keithfosterkid.com. I've done some shows at Old Town Improv Company over the holiday. We did a really fun improv versus stand-up show where we do improv sets based off of stand-up comedians' jokes, and that went really well. So check out my website, and I have a calendar with upcoming show dates. I do specifically have I'm going to be at the Comedy Palace Saturday, January 12th. I'll be at the 7:30 show and the 9:30 show, and then Book Club is coming back at the end of January, January 19th. We're starting a new genre. We're going to do an improvised pirate adventure. And then I should have another alt-comedia show at the end of the month. Yeah, so just check out my website. Check out my calendar for upcoming show dates. Hopefully I've got some more fun stuff in the pipeline for you guys soon.
Cool. And be sure to check out our friends out there in the podcast universe, including Patrick and Dennis over at Almost Educational. I did an episode with him recently. It might be the last episode they still have up there, but go check. And check out Bill and Brian over at the Great Albums Podcast, which I will be a guest on here in the next couple weeks. And go check out Buddy and Alice over at Those Happy Places. And I think Alice, yeah, I keep always forget, but they just followed us on Twitter. The Rogue Fun, a Star Wars podcast. Check that one out. The exclusively about Rogue One Star Wars podcast she does. And Mike Fallick over at Hack Thought.
Also, be sure to check out Adam Connie at the Adamant Podcast and Campfire Shit Show with no I. Campfire SHT Show with Marilyn Poe.
Mm-hmm. Just going to tease this out here at the very end. There is some things happening in the future of this podcast or these podcast hosts. And as things develop more and we know more about how what kind of transition we're going to take with this podcast, I will let people know. I don't want to scare people. If you are one of our few listeners who really care, the format of the show isn't going to change, but maybe where you find it is. So I will let everyone know and make that explicit on all of our social media, which is another reason why you should be following us on social media, is to know where we might change location.
Mm-hmm. But hopefully this is going to be good news. So
good news, exciting news. And yeah. This could be a new era, a new morning in America, as Ronald Reagan said.
All right. And on that note, Autobots, roll out.